Morocco, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Lebanon, Oman, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. If only there was a way to uncover a unifying rubric for these bastions of love, peace, and tolerance. Examining a society's attitudes towards gay people serves as another valuable indicator of tolerance. Pew conducted a global survey in 2013 asking respondents whether homosexuality should be rejected by society. Islamic countries led the way in intolerance toward gays. Here are some of the relevant data. Senegal, 98%. Jordan, 97%. Egypt, 95%. Tunisia, 94%. The Palestinian territories, 93%. Indonesia, 93%. Pakistan, 87%. Malaysia, 86%. Lebanon, 80%. Turkey, 78%. The Western LGBTQ activists who belong to or support Queers for Palestine might be interested to know that Israel, even counting its Muslim population, is more than twice as tolerant of homosexuals as is Palestine. Incidentally, homosexuality can merit a death sentence in 10 countries: Yemen, Iran, Mauritania, Nigeria, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Somalia, Sudan, and United Arab Emirates. How well do women fare around the world? In 2018, the World Economic Forum released the Global Gender Gap Report, wherein countries were ranked in terms of gender gaps in four domains: health, education, economics, and politics. Out of 149 countries, here are the 20 worst for women in decreasing rank order: Turkey, Ivory Coast, Bahrain, Nigeria, Togo, Egypt, Mauritania, Morocco, Jordan, Oman, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Mali, Democratic Republic of Congo, Chad, Syria, Iraq, Pakistan, and Yemen. In 2018, the Foundation for the Advancement of Liberty, a Spanish libertarian think tank, released its 2018 World Index of Moral Freedom, wherein 160 countries were ranked on a composite score composed of five freedom measures. Here are the rankings of the 14 worst countries in decreasing order: Libya, Oman, Algeria, Brunei, Pakistan, Iran, Egypt, Afghanistan, Kuwait, Qatar, Iraq, United Arab Emirates, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia. These nations vary along ethnic, racial, linguistic, economic, and socio-political metrics, but they have one thing in common. The West believes in freedom of conscience when it comes to religion, but not every country in the world shares that view. Here are the countries that currently impose a death penalty for atheism: Afghanistan, Iran, Malaysia, Maldives, Mauritania, Nigeria, Pakistan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, Sudan, United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. Moreover, the Pew Research Center examined which countries have the most governmental restrictions on religion. Combining the data from the 2013 and 2014 surveys, the 20 worst countries are China, Indonesia, Uzbekistan, Iran, Egypt, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Malaysia, Burma, Russia, Syria, Turkey, Azerbaijan, Sudan, Brunei, Eritrea, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Laos, and the Maldives. 75% of the worst countries are Muslim-majority nations. The building of this nomological network, composed of heterogeneous, confirmatory, cumulative evidence, is not, of course, an attack on individual Muslims. It is the application of a dispassionate epistemological approach to scrutinizing an ideology and establishing whether it promotes peace, pluralism, and liberty. The conclusion of this analysis is veridical, even though the great majority of Muslims are undoubtedly kind and decent people. In a free society, people should be able to analyze such data without accusations of bigotry. That is how we come to the truth. The application of nomological networks of cumulative evidence is relevant to countless other contemporary hot-button issues. Take, for example, the ongoing debates regarding man-made climate change. The discussion is laden with hysterical, emotional appeals, as exemplified by Greta Thunberg, the 17-year-old Swedish activist who, in a disturbingly angry, sanctimonious, and eschatological United Nations speech, proclaimed that the failure of Western adults to act against climate change had robbed her and future generations of childhood innocence. Nomological networks of cumulative evidence might be deployed to examine the extent to which climate change is man-made, and subsequently to explore the types of intervention strategies that are feasible, practical, and rational. To request that such an analysis be carried out does not make one a climate denier or a science denier. Nomological networks of cumulative evidence inoculate us against the quicksand of feel-good platitudes and emotional appeals. Let your intellect, not misplaced emotions or tribal ideologies, inform your positions. To be a truly wise person requires that we recognize those domains best served by our intellect versus those best guided by our emotions. Stay loyal to the tribe of truth by applying the powerful epistemological tool covered in this chapter, informing your position. Ask yourself, what would be the cumulative evidence that I need to cull in support of my position? Nomological networks of cumulative evidence constitute a powerful means by which we can synthesize complex information in our quest to make rational decisions. Chapter 8. Call to Action. First they came for the communists, and I did not speak out, because I was not a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out, because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out, because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. Martin Niemöller, German theologian. A time comes when silence is betrayal, as quoted by Martin Luther King Jr. All things being equal, whether you are talking about a military conflict or the battle of ideas, it is generally better to have a large army than a small one. The more people we have defending our core values, the more likely we are to triumph against the enemies of reason. And yet, countless persons who share our values fail to speak out. The reasons are manifold. Most people are too busy to notice the dangers of idea pathogens or wrongly assume that they are unimportant. The intrusion of anti-science, anti-reason, and illiberal movements occurs slowly and incrementally without many people becoming aware of the larger problem. Hence, the slow and inexorable death of the West by a thousand cuts. Instead of ignoring the problem, recognize that while it affects others today, it could reach you tomorrow. You may not have children in college, but if you work for a firm or are perhaps a business owner, campus lunacy will affect your business soon, if it does not already, perhaps starting with your human resources department and the enforcement of, quote, progressive government regulations that demand adherence to the cult of diversity, inclusion, and equity. Parts of Europe already have Sharia enclaves that are no-go areas for infidels and the police. You might not have them in your city yet, but your nation's immigration policies and ostrich parasitic syndrome may bring no-go areas sooner rather than later. Another reason people are reluctant to join the battle of ideas is what we call diffusion of responsibility, or the bystander effect. In the late 1960s, psychologists John Darley and Bibb Latané documented what at first glance seems counterintuitive. The greater the number of people present, the less likely an individual is to help someone in need, because it is easier to rationalize that someone else will do it. It is easy to diffuse responsibility to others who are willing to stick their necks out. Thank you, Dr. Saad, for standing up on our behalf. I really support your efforts. You got this. No, I don't. Everybody has a voice. Activate your sense of personal responsibility. You have agency. Participate. Do not be a bystander as truth, reason, and logic call out for your help. Do not subcontract your voice to others. Do not self-censor. You and your children have a stake in the outcome of this battle, so don't be afraid to speak up. Do not succumb to the tragedy of the commons, as popularized by the ecologist Garrett Hardin in 1968, in this case, a tragedy of collective inaction. The battle of ideas knows no boundaries, so there is plenty to do. If you are a student and hear your professors spouting postmodern nonsense or spewing anti-science drivel, challenge them politely and constructively. If you are a graduate and your alma mater is violating its commitment to freedom of speech and freedom of thought, withdraw your donations and let the school know why. If your Facebook friends are posting comments with which you disagree, engage them and offer an alternative viewpoint. Do not fear the possible loss of friendship. Anyone who is willing to end a relationship because of a reasoned difference of opinion is not worthy of your friendship. If you are sitting at your local pub having a conversation about a sensitive topic, do not refrain from speaking your mind. If your politicians are succumbing to suicidal political correctness, vote them out of office. Donald Trump won the United States presidency in 2016 because a silent electoral majority in the middle of America shouted from the ballot box, "We are tired of being patronized. We are tired of politically correct platitudes. We are tired of identity politics and the ethos of victimhood. We are tired of the extraordinarily biased mainstream media." And by expressing their frustration on Election Day, they won. Believe in the power of your voice. Social media, despite big tech's nefarious actions to silence or punish some voices, has democratized media platforms. And no matter how small your media platform is initially, it can grow exponentially. Mark Dawson self-published his way into becoming a best-selling thriller writer, who now garners a very sizable yearly income. Andy Weir's The Martian, which was originally self-published online and then sold on Kindle for 99 cents, was eventually adapted into a blockbuster Hollywood movie directed by Ridley Scott and starring Matt Damon. PewDiePie is a YouTube channel hosted by Swedish gamer Felix Kjellberg. It is one of the most popular channels, with more than 100 million subscribers and more than 25 billion total views as of May 2020. Kjellberg's yearly income is now well over $10 million, which is not too shabby for a university dropout. Joe Rogan, with whom I have developed a warm friendship, has created the most popular podcast in the world. He holds long-format conversations with a very eclectic group of guests, including, but not limited to, scientists, entrepreneurs, athletes, actors, and comedians. His yearly downloads are well into the hundreds of millions. How did he start out? He was a college dropout, with a short career as a martial artist, and a longer career as a stand-up comedian, actor, television host, and Ultimate Fighting Championship commentator. His open-mindedness and willingness to engage a broad range of individuals, the antithesis of an echo chamber, has been handsomely rewarded. Rogan earned $30 million last year from his podcast alone. Dave Rubin also started off as a stand-up comic, but today he is the host of a fully independent show, The Rubin Report, where he holds meaningful conversations with people from across the political spectrum, and has more than 1 million subscribers and more than 260 million total views as of June 2020. Granted, most people who self-publish or start a YouTube channel will not find an audience of hundreds of thousands, but in the battle of ideas, every voice counts. Even if your circle of influence is limited to your family, friends, and neighbors. Do not be afraid of judging others or giving offense. Many people, of course, worry about straining friendships if they broach sensitive topics. But true friendships are precisely those that should withstand the stress of such conversations. A deep friendship should be anti-fragile, to use the concept of Nassim Taleb. The English historian Henry Thomas Buckle famously remarked, "Men and women range themselves into three classes or orders of intelligence. You can tell the lowest class by their habit of always talking about persons, the next by the fact that their habit is always to converse about things, the highest by their preference for the discussion of ideas." I would argue that a similar taxonomy captures the strength of a friendship. Idle chatter is well suited for breaking the ice with strangers and engaging in banter with acquaintances. Deep, meaningful conversations about important ideas in politics and religion should be a central feature of any valuable friendship. If so-called friends are unable to accept a difference of opinion on a substantive issue, then they are unworthy of your friendship. Two poignant French sayings come to mind. One, mieux vaut être seul que mal accompagné, better to be alone than poorly accompanied, and two, dis-moi qui sont tes amis et je te dirai qui tu es. Tell me who your friends are, and I'll tell you who you are. Humans are a social species. We thrive emotionally and cognitively when we forge intense bonds of friendship. In the pursuit of happiness, we should strive to establish friendships with individuals with whom we can experience the full range of cerebral engagement. This can't happen if we are too afraid to disagree with our close friends on consequential issues. Choose your friends wisely. In a similar way, many well-intentioned individuals are too afraid to judge others. The Cambridge Dictionary lists the following synonyms and related words for non-judgmental: open-minded, enlightened, free-thinking, inclusive, liberal, live and let live idiom, permissive society, and tolerant. Recall the colloquialisms that speak to this aversion to judge. Who am I to judge? I am not one to judge. No judgment. Where does this reticence stem from? The West is founded on a bedrock of Judeo-Christian traditions, and many assume, as per Christian theology, that judging others can be a sin. Several Gospels contain edicts against judging others. In the Pericope Adultery, John 7:53-8:11, Jesus says, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." In reference to the imminent stoning of a woman who has committed adultery, and in Matthew 7:1-2, one finds, "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." In Luke 6:37, we have, "Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven." Finally, James 4:12 posits, "There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and destroy. But you, who are you to judge your neighbor?" Many people interpret these teachings as implying that the act of judging is divinely forbidden, a cosmic command to live and let live. But this is incorrect. These edicts are referring to moral hypocrisy. People who spew falsehoods should be judged. I do it every day. Cultural relativism also impedes people from casting judgments, especially against otherwise abhorrent religious and cultural practices. Several generations of university students have been indoctrinated into the false belief that it is gauche, if not bigoted, to judge people of different ethnic or religious backgrounds, especially if you are a white Westerner. In April 2011, the University of Notre Dame hosted a debate between William Lane Craig, a Christian theologian, and Sam Harris, an atheist neuroscientist, on the natural versus supernatural foundations of morality. During the debate, Harris recounted an anecdote that perfectly summarizes the moral blindness that cultural relativism engenders. It centered around a conversation he had with an appointee to President Obama's Council on Bioethics. She said, "How could you ever say that forcing women to wear burqas is wrong from the point of view of science?" I said, "Well, because I think it's pretty clear that right and wrong relate to human well-being, and it's just as clear that forcing half the population to live in cloth bags and beating them or killing them when they try to get out is not a way of maximizing human well-being." And she said, "Well, that's just your opinion." And I said, "Well, okay, let's make it even easier. Let's say we found a culture that was literally removing the eyeballs of every third child, okay, at birth. Would you then agree that we have found a culture that is not perfectly maximizing well-being?" And she said, "It would depend on why they were doing it." So, After my eyebrows returned from the back of my head, I said, "Okay, well, say they were doing it for religious reasons. Let's say they have a scripture which says, every third should walk in darkness, or some such nonsense." And then she said, "Well, then, you could never say that they were wrong." Harris pointed out that this same individual had deep moral reservations about using brain imaging as a lie-detecting technology on apprehended terrorists. Pause for a moment to marvel at how broken this individual's moral compass is. She was callously unconcerned about the removal of children's eyes, should such barbarism be done in the service of a grotesque religious belief, and she was not the least bit disturbed by women's being forced to wear the burqa because this was done in the service of Islamic religious belief. But don't you dare infringe on a terrorist's neuronal freedom. This immoral and confused individual had succumbed to two biases, namely a devastating case of cultural relativism mixed with the ethos of cultural self-flagellation. She was perfectly happy to hold her own culture to astonishingly punishing moral standards in the handling of a captured terrorist, but she was unable to judge the barbaric behaviors of people from other cultures or religions. This is the epitome of moral cowardice. To judge is to be human. It is perfectly natural to judge others. It is an integral part of being a well-functioning adult. A central feature of human decision-making is the process of judging several competing alternatives. This is precisely why the Society for Judgment and Decision-Making and its flagship journal, Judgment and Decision-Making, exist. We judge whom to include within our close circle of friends. We judge various prospective suitors prior to marrying our eventual spouse. We judge the performance of our students and employees. Life is laden with endless judgments. If I were to ask you to think about the people whom you consider to be most interesting, they would likely have one thing in common. They judge. They opine. They take positions. Fence sitters who equivocate about the pros and cons of every conceivable issue without ever pronouncing a judgment are profoundly boring people. To never judge is to be an intellectual coward, for it serves as an insurance policy against the possibility of being a polarizing figure. The most charismatic public intellectuals are typically those who share their judgments on a broad range of issues. Thomas Sowell and the late Christopher Hitchens are two of the leading public intellectuals of the past four decades, precisely because they never shied away from sharing their opinions on contentious issues. Of course, not all judgments are created equal. The difference between a judgmental ideologue and a judgmental intellectual is the process by which each arrives at his position. As long as one uses well-articulated arguments in support of one's judgments, it is perfectly acceptable to judge. Do not virtue signal. Each time that a terrorist attack takes place in some Western city, nauseating hordes of cowards do one of two things. One, change their social media handles to the flag of the country that was attacked. Two, share a hashtag on Twitter to signal their solidarity with a given cause, hashtag Je suis Charlie, following the terror killings at the Charlie Hebdo offices in Paris, hashtag Bring Back Our Girls, made famous by Michelle Obama, in support of the Nigerian girls kidnapped by Boko Haram. Politicians seek to outdo one another in offering vacuous, quote, heartfelt condolences, while in many cases continuing to enact policies that are directly responsible for the terror attacks in question. In the great majority of instances, these are utterly useless endeavors meant to do nothing but advertise one's supposed virtue to the world, hence the term virtue signaling. It is a form of cheap and costless self-aggrandizing that feeds one's ego. I must be a good person who truly cares, as evidenced by my progressive hashtag. Nothing can be further from the truth. Those who engage in such platitudinous signaling are cowardly and meek. I'll use some fundamental principles from evolutionary biology to explain why this is so. Recall that the struggle for life involves two fundamental challenges: survival and reproduction. In a sexually reproducing species, individual organisms must ensure that they will survive until reproductive age, at which time they must possess desirable attributes to attract a suitable mate. Adaptations evolve either because they bestow a survival advantage to an organism or because they yield a reproductive advantage. When it comes to survival, the two fundamental challenges can be boiled down to get food and avoid becoming someone else's food. The beaks of Darwin's finches evolved to be of different forms as a result of selection pressures in various local niches due to the specific availability of foods in those environments. A thinner beak might result in a survival advantage on one of the Galapagos Islands, whereas a thicker one would be ideal on another island. A morphological trait, type of beak, evolved as a means of procuring food sources. Unless an organism is the apex predator within a given ecosystem, it is under constant threat of predation. The evolution of camouflaging serves as an example of how an organism avoids becoming a predator's next meal. Leaf insects have evolved exoskeletons that allow them to blend seamlessly into their environments with both coloring and textural camouflage. Recall, though, that survival is only half the battle. An organism must reproduce in order to ensure its reproductive fitness. There are two types of adaptations that bestow a mating benefit: those that evolve for intersexual wooing, the peacock's tail, the moonwalk dance of the red-capped manakin, or for intrasexual competition, moose antlers, the cranial structure of rams for butting heads. In other words, behavioral or morphological features evolve to either impress members of the opposite sex or to directly compete with members of one sex for mating rights. The astute reader might ask at this point, what does all of this have to do with virtue signaling? For this, we turn to the peacock's tail. This morphological feature evolved via female mate choice, despite the fact that it disadvantages the survivability of the peacock by increasing the likelihood of its predation. Why would peahens find a very large tail comprised of beautifully patterned plumage with dazzling colors so alluring? Choosing the right mate is a profoundly important decision to the genetic interests of any organism. With such high stakes at play, it is necessary that an organism find a way to differentiate prospective suitors into one of two broad categories: unworthy fakers and worthy candidates. Evolution has solved this conundrum in an extraordinarily elegant and efficient manner. Trustworthy signals must be costly in order to serve as honest depictions of an organism's quality. In other words, they must be handicapping in a way that they exclude the pretenders and fakers from being able to pull off the same signal. The peacock is effectively communicating the following: the beauty of my plumage tells you that I'm free of parasites. My elaborate tail makes me more prone to predation, and yet here I am. I must be the real deal. The fakers can't pull this off. Pick me. I've used this principle in explaining many human phenomena, including conspicuous consumption, purchasing a Ferrari, philanthropy, non-anonymous donations to signal one's status, art collecting, spending outlandish prices on infantile art that a monkey could have created, and rappers shown throwing away huge wads of money in music videos. Only those sufficiently wealthy could be so cavalier in their pecuniary waste. Costly signaling is also relevant in explaining rites of passage across various cultures, meant to serve as an honest signal of one's courage, bravery, and toughness. The Satari Mawi, an indigenous Amazonian tribe, have a very powerful way of differentiating prospective warriors from their fake counterparts. They sedate bullet ants, whose sting is akin to being shot, and then weave them into leaf gloves. Initiates wear the gloves for several minutes and must withstand the stings of hundreds of these ants as they come out of their sedated torpor. One sting causes unimaginable pain, and yet the inductees must withstand the suffering with restrained dignity. They cannot holler. One such ordeal would be sufficient to test anyone's toughness, and yet the young men must endure this tribulation 20 separate times. If all it took to become a warrior was the completion of 10 push-ups, nearly everyone could complete the task. It would leave the tribe in the unenviable position of not knowing who the truly tough individuals were. However, create a rite of passage that serves as an honest signal of toughness and courage, and you've solved the problem of identifying the fakers. During a highly publicized 2017 event held in Toronto, Oren Amite, Jordan Peterson, and I were asked to identify our respective freedom of speech heroes. I responded that the ultimate heroes are those who risk their lives to defend such freedoms. I pointed to individuals from the Middle East, some of whom have been guests on my show, who are willing to defend these ideals, knowing full well that they may pay the ultimate price. This is what having skin in the game looks like. This is costly virtue, not virtue signaling. Over the past year or so, I have become good friends with Ensaf Haidar, the wife of jailed Saudi blogger Raif Badawi, and I had the pleasure of meeting her three lovely children at a dinner organized by the actor Mark Pellegrino and his wife. Raif is serving a 10-year prison sentence and was scheduled to receive 1,000 lashes, quote, only 50 of which have thus far been administered, for having the temerity to question, in a rather tepid manner, various religious and cultural realities in the region. Retweeting hashtag Je suis Charlie is impotent virtue signaling. Critiquing the Saudi regime from within Saudi Arabia is courage in action. Many people living in the West tell me they want to defend our liberties, but cannot do so publicly because they could suffer professional or social consequences. Therein lies the problem. Did the young Allied soldiers landing on the shores of Normandy in World War II ask for, or expect, a guarantee of their safety before charging German machine guns and mortars? We recently commemorated the centenary of the end of World War I, where nearly 67,000 Canadians lost their lives. Their selfless heroism granted me the freedom to type what you are currently reading. Millions of individuals have sacrificed their lives so that your children and mine could live in free societies. And yet, most people today are unwilling to speak their minds, lest they be unfriended by an acquaintance on Facebook. Cowardice should be added to the list of seven deadly sins. There is no way to participate in the grand battle of ideas for the soul of the West without facing any threats. Most people recognize the gargantuan courage that is required to speak my mind in the manner that I do, especially so as an academic and public figure. There isn't a sacred belief that I'm unwilling to critique, and yet, whenever I implore people to get engaged, I am at times flippantly told, "But professor, you are protected by tenure." Tenure is not an all-encompassing magical shield that repels all the threats and harmful consequences that can come from being an outspoken defender of reason. Tenure did not protect me from having to take security measures in fall 2017 whenever I went to teach classes at my university. Tenure did not protect me from the innumerable death threats that I've received, which led to my having to file a report with the Montreal police while accompanied by a human resources representative from my university. Tenure did not protect me from the numerous professorships that I would have received from other institutions were it not for my public engagement, including a very lucrative professorship at my dream location. Tenure did not protect me from being ostracized from many of the academic circles that serve as gatekeepers for the advancement of my career. My purity of spirit, as I recall my mother's words, does not permit me to place any careerist considerations ahead of my defense of truth. I would not be able to sleep at night knowing that I had sacrificed a millimeter of truth or an ounce of freedom for selfish reasons. My best advice is, if you are going to fight these idea pathogens, go all in. Make your engagement count. In the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle argues that a successful and happy life requires that one find moderation in the pursuit of a given virtue. Think of the adage, all good things in moderation. Aristotle proposed that courage, a virtue, lies between excessive fearlessness and cowardice, the two extremes that ought to be avoided. Aristotle discusses the courage of a soldier in physical battle, but in the current context, it applies to intellectual courage as needed for the battle of ideas. An individual who decides to wear a Draw Muhammad t-shirt in Yemen to protest Islamic blasphemy laws is undoubtedly exhibiting excessive fearlessness. On the other hand, the media's reluctance to challenge an imam's statement that, quote, Islam is peace, is a manifestation of cowardice. Between these two endpoints lies the sweet spot of tempered and reasoned engagement. Be the penalty kicker. Soccer, better known as football to the rest of the world outside North America, is a low-scoring sport. Of all possible game situations, the penalty kick yields the highest probability of scoring a goal. A penalty kick is awarded when a foul, like tripping an opposing player, is committed inside the 18-yard box. The ball is placed in the center of the field, 12 yards away from the net, and a designated penalty kicker takes a shot solely against the goalkeeper. The success rate is around 70%, so the pressure is largely on the kicker. In addition to penalty kicks awarded during a game, penalty shootouts are used to break ties in tournament games. It takes testicular fortitude to make a kick under such crushing pressure, but it is a fortitude that we all have to cultivate because now we are all playing in the World Cup of ideas. All of us need to step up and take metaphorical penalty kicks when we have a chance to score a goal for team reason. There are two types of people: those who see a woman being accosted in an alley and intervene, and those who furtively walk by, pretending that they never heard her screams for help. Be the former and not the latter. Activate your inner honey badger. Honey badgers are fearlessly ferocious when attacked. A single honey badger, the size of a small dog, is so extraordinarily aggressive that it can fend off a group of lions. If you attack it, prepare to fight. Given the ubiquity of e-mob bullying, which is really a form of thought policing, let the honey badger serve as your source of inspiration. Never back down from those seeking to intimidate you into silence. Shortly after Serena Williams lost to Naomi Osaka at the 2018 final of the U.S. Open Tennis Championships, I commented on social media about Williams' execrable behavior during the match. She was penalized for receiving illegal coaching, for smashing her racket in anger, and for verbally abusing the umpire, calling him a thief, and later effectively accusing him of sexism. As you might expect in today's zeitgeist, it is seldom a good idea to criticize a black woman, because you set yourself up for false charges of sexism and racism. I was hardly surprised when I began receiving many angry responses to my criticisms of Williams, but one diabolically unhinged woman decided I had committed an unforgivable sin and wanted to terminate my academic career. She tagged my university on Twitter, hoping it would respond by firing me. Refusing to bow to such cretinous pressure, I went on the offensive. I highlighted what this woman was doing, and many supporters of mine weighed in against this would-be social justice warrior, who realized she was unable to defend her position. She deleted some of her own tweets, eventually shut down her Twitter account, and then tagged me from a new Twitter account demanding that I remove her earlier tweets and my responses. I refused. She ludicrously threatened to sue me for, quote, defamation, and she eventually disappeared into her black hole of faux outrage. There are two important lessons to take away from this story. First, never ever cede an inch to those who wish to silence you. Today it's an inch, tomorrow it will be a yard. Second, learn the strategies that these enemies of freedom utilize to bully others, and try to turn these against them. In my case, I hold a winning hand in victimology poker. I am a Lebanese Jew, and hence a person of color, to use the obnoxious parlance of the social justice warriors. I am a war refugee who escaped religious persecution, and I am a, quote, person of size. I am overweight. It is difficult to beat me in the oppression Olympics, and accordingly I utilize my royal flush of victimhood against those who typically seek to accuse me of faux racism, faux sexism, and faux bigotry. In my tormentor's case, she was a white American woman, and so I accused her of coming after me, perhaps because she harbored hatred against my identity via her, quote, privileged position of whiteness. This is the proverbial kryptonite against these charlatans of faux justice. And so, unsurprisingly, she went away. I have been targeted for occupational harassment on a few other occasions, perhaps most notably in fall 2017. As a general rule, I try to reduce my interactions with detractors to a minimum on social media, because it seldom yields satisfactory outcomes. However, once in a while, I get suckered into a spicy exchange. An obnoxious and insulting individual had denigrated me on Twitter in a truly bewildering way, at which point I joined the thread and went after him full throttle. This included my referring to him as a retarded schmuck and a degenerate, but always within the strict confines of semi-friendly banter. It would seem that he did not possess the emotional fortitude to handle such retorts. He first tried to muster a charge of bigotry against me because, using his lobotomized logic, my use of the word degenerate was somehow code language for homophobia. I had no inkling of the biological sex of the individual in question, let alone his or her sexual orientation. When this tactic did not stick, he began to repeatedly tag my university, seeking to get me in trouble with my employer. When this did not work, he contacted my university and filed a complaint against me. I know this because I received an ominous email from a representative from my university's human resources department asking to speak to me urgently, without telling me what the issue was about. We agreed to have a phone chat that evening to discuss the matter. When she confirmed to me that the complaint stemmed from the Twitter person in question, I went on the offensive. I reminded her that I was communicating via my personal Twitter account to a person who was not in any way associated with my professorial duties at my institution. I offered her a hypothetical example to ponder. If she were with her daughter at a pharmacy, and I saw her there, and thought she spoke to her daughter offensively, would it be acceptable for me to call the university and report her? The conversation ended shortly thereafter, and the case was closed. When dealing with miscreants, appeasement is seldom a winning strategy. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's policy of appeasing Adolf Hitler was a notorious failure, and many governments today refuse to negotiate with terrorists because they know it only brings more demands for appeasement. Israel does not appease its enemies because it knows that in the Near East, might is right. In the West, however, blubbering apologies when none are needed has become de rigueur. On October 7, 2018, astronaut Scott Kelly tweeted, "One of the greatest leaders of modern times, Sir Winston Churchill said, 'In victory, magnanimity.' I guess those days are over." The usual online mob of faux outrage jumped into action, saying that Kelly had cited a genocidal racist. Apparently, Churchill is just as bad as Hitler. Kelly issued a Twitter apology the following day. "Did not mean to offend by quoting Churchill. My apologies. I will go and educate myself further on his atrocities, racist views, which I do not support. My point was we need to come together as one nation. We are all Americans. That should transcend partisan politics." I tweeted several replies to Kelly's cowardly caving, including this: "Stop apologizing. Stop compromising your positions for fear that you might offend the perpetually offended. Grow a pair. Stand tall. Be confident in your personhood. Know which side of the track truth is to be found. Stop the cowardice. Stop it at Station CDR Kelly." If quoting a key historical figure who helped defeat the Nazis necessitates an apology, the abyss of infinite darkness looms. If you support the foundational principles of Western civilization, if you stand for freedom of speech and thought, as Churchill did, then don't retreat. Let your animal spirit be that of the honey badger. Be ferociously uncompromising in defending your integrity and in protecting truth. Follow the lead of Gibson's Bakery, whose owners sued Oberlin College, a hotbed of leftist lunacy, for its role in promulgating the false narrative that the bakery was guilty of racism. 3 black students had been caught shoplifting, and when they were confronted by an employee, the owner's son, they assaulted him. The students admitted their guilt and confirmed that no racism had taken place, and yet Oberlin was instrumental in stirring the faux outrage. The bakery was awarded a $44 million judgment, although this has since been reduced. The bakery did not cave to the protests, boycotts, and false accusations. It did not issue an abject apology, saying the owners had learned a valuable lesson from, quote, people of color. No, they fought this grotesque injustice and won. Be a honey badger. Never back down when attacked by ideological bullies. To criticize Islam does not make you an Islamophobe, a nonsensical term, nor a hater of individual Muslims. To scrutinize radical feminism does not make you a misogynist. To question open borders does not make you a racist. You can have an open heart filled with empathy and compassion and yet reject open borders. To assert that trans women, biological males, should not be competing in athletic competitions with biological females does not make you a transphobe. Many situations in life involve a calculus of competing rights. With that in mind, the right of your 8-year-old daughter to feel comfortable and safe in a public bathroom supersedes that of a 230-pound, 6-foot-2 trans woman. To reject the idea that so-called other forms of knowing, whether the indigenous way of knowing or postmodernism, are as valid as the scientific method, does not make you a close-minded bigot. To reject the hysterical demonization of white men as exemplars of toxic masculinity and white supremacy does not make you Adolf Hitler. The name-calling accusations are locked and loaded threats ready to be deployed against you should you dare to question the relevant progressive tenets. Most people are too afraid to be accused of being racist or misogynist, and so they cower in silence. Keep your mouth shut and nod in agreement, or else prepare to be tarred and feathered. Don't fall prey to this silencing strategy. Be assured in your principles and stand ready to defend them with the ferocity of a honey badger. How to fix our universities. While civil and aeronautical engineers are constrained by physical laws when designing bridges and planes, the humanities professors spreading anti-science, anti-logic idea pathogens are impervious to downstream ill effects. These professors have created a university culture where insanity is rewarded. This must stop. And the first step might be to fight back against unconstitutional speech codes and delimited free speech zones. Under the Constitution, the entire United States is a free speech zone. Say no to the thought police. Expose your mind to a heterogeneity of thoughts and perspectives, and engage with people who might question your positions. Ideological intolerance is not restricted to conservatives or liberals. Every one of us prefers talking with people who share our opinions. That is an indelible part of human nature. But our minds are elevated when we discuss opposing points of view respectfully. This should be a major focus of our universities. Similarly, our universities should recommit themselves to the pursuit of academic excellence and kick identity politics and its cult of diversity, inclusion, and equity into the dustbin of history. No one should have to apologize for being white, male, Christian, or heterosexual, or feel, quote, pride in their sexual orientation. Immutable characteristics should not be the subject of either pride or shame. And we should neither inculcate or placate an ethos of perpetual victimhood and indignant offense. We should stop coddling students and provide no allowances for trigger warnings or safe spaces, no indulgence for the foolishness of, quote, cultural appropriation or, quote, microaggressions. These are nonsensical concepts that embolden weakness and fragility. Instead, foster an environment that promotes intellectual and emotional strength. In the words of John Ellison, Dean of Students in the College at the University of Chicago, in his welcoming letter to the class of 2020, members of our community are encouraged to speak, write, listen, challenge, and learn without fear of censorship. Civility and mutual respect are vital to all of us. And freedom of expression does not mean the freedom to harass or threaten others. You will find that we expect members of our community to be engaged in rigorous debate, discussion, and even disagreement. At times, this may challenge you and even cause discomfort. Our commitment to academic freedom means that we do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial. And we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own. Fostering the free exchange of ideas reinforces a related university priority: building a campus that welcomes people of all backgrounds. Diversity of opinion and background is a fundamental strength of our community. The members of our community must have the freedom to espouse and explore a wide range of ideas. It is tragic that such a position has to be enunciated to incoming students at a world-class university in the 21st century. And yet, Dean Ellison is a breath of fresh air in an ecosystem of fevered idea pathogens. They are the same sort of idea pathogens that encourage students to occupy administrators' offices with lists of outlandish social justice demands, and that all too often lead administrators to capitulate to them. I encourage readers to flip through the Plan for Dartmouth's Freedom Budget, Items for Transformative Justice at Dartmouth, to better understand what such demands entail. But you can probably guess. Universities need to return to the meritocratic ethos they once had and to resist commodifying education and lowering academic standards. In 1990, when I earned my MBA at McGill University, I had to complete 2 years of full-time studies, that is, 4 semesters of courses ranging from 5 to 6 graduate courses per semester, an extraordinarily heavy load. I was exempted from 1 additional course by passing an entrance mathematics exam. Since then, the number of credits required to obtain an MBA degree continues to decrease, with many business schools now offering an accelerated 1-year MBA. At the business school where I teach, the number of credits now required for completing an MBA is substantially lower than it was when I graduated back in 1990. More than a decade ago, I critiqued this outlandish lowering of standards in a Psychology Today article titled, "I'll Have Large Fries, a Hamburger, a Diet Coke, and an MBA. Hold the Pickles." The student as customer metaphor is poor educational policy. MBA requirements are being watered down not because students are much smarter and better prepared than they were 30 years ago, but because of competitive pressures for schools to find new ways to attract students. This same desire to attract and retain students manifests itself in grade inflation. Stuart Roystager, a former professor of geology, earth, and ocean sciences at Duke University, has conducted extensive longitudinal analyses on the pattern of grade inflation at American universities. He reports some truly bewildering grade facts, including that the most common grade during the Vietnam era was C. Now it is an A. Yes, you read that correctly. Everyone is a winner. Everyone comes in first place. Everyone gets a trophy. Incredibly, some leading business schools, law schools, and medical schools have done away with standard letter grading and instead focus on versions of the pass-fail system. At my alma mater, Cornell University, students have enacted a grade non-disclosure policy. Recruiters are not supposed to ask Cornell students about their grades, and Cornell students are not supposed to reveal their grades until after they've received a full-time job offer. Humans are both cooperative and competitive, and any group, from a clique of awkward teenagers to a professional soccer team to a military organization, will establish clear hierarchies. Humans are not indistinguishable and equal worker ants. E.O. Wilson, the Harvard entomologist and evolutionary biologist, is reputed to have said of socialism, "Great idea. Wrong species." Any system that is built on a false understanding of human nature is doomed to fail. Building a society where the primary objective is to protect one's fragile self-esteem from the dangers of competition will only lead to a society of weakness, entitlement, and apathy. Life is necessarily competitive. Society is necessarily hierarchical. It does no one any favors to pursue a utopian vision of society where no one's feelings are hurt. Parting words. For decades now, a set of idea pathogens, largely stemming from universities, has relentlessly assaulted science, reason, logic, freedom of thought, freedom of speech, individual liberty, and individual dignity. If we want our children and our grandchildren to grow up in free societies as we have done, then we have to be assured in our principles and stand ready to defend them. Having grown up amidst the brutality of the Lebanese Civil War and witnessed the erosion of common sense in our universities, I implore you to get engaged. You have the power to effect necessary change. The cure is before you. It is the pursuit and the defense of truth. It is the recommitment to the virtues of the Western scientific revolution and the Age of Enlightenment. March on, soldiers of reason. Together, we can win the battle of ideas. This concludes the reading of The Parasitic Mind, How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense by Gad Saad. Copyright 2020 by Gad Saad. This book was read by Jim Meskimen. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Regnery Publishing and was produced in 2020 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.